This podcast is presented by the Prince George's County Memorial Library System.
Hi, I'm Heather.
I'm Kelsey.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Emmy.
And this is our podcast, These Books Made Me. Today, we're going to be starting our American Girl series of episodes, starting with Kirsten and her books. Friendly warning, as always. This podcast contains spoilers. If you don't yet know how much house you can buy with grave-robbed fur, proceed with caution. Okay, everybody, was this anyone's first time reading these books?
It wasn't my first time. I read them as a kid. Full disclosure, I did not have the Kirsten doll. I had the Felicity doll, so I hope I'm not going to be kicked off the podcast. But my sister had Kirsten, and so we both read, I think, all the books.
We might want to mention that we do have two Kirsten doll guest stars with us today, mine and Kelsey's.
Yes, I have Kirsten. She's near and dear to my heart. She's the only American Girl doll I had. So I'm really excited that she's kicking off our series. And reading these books took me like all the way back. Like I saw the first picture of Kirsten and Marta with their like heads touching and I was like, oh my God, I just remember, like, I wanted a friend like Marta so bad, and I, like, loved their relationship, even though in retrospect, there's, like, not a lot to it. But as a kid, I, like, loved it so much. So, this was really nice to go back and reread.
I feel the same. It's definitely not my first time reading Kirsten when I was younger. It sounds like many of you. I read all of the American Girl books, and I loved them so much, and I reread them. A lot of my friends read the books. And we also put on some of the American Girl plays when I was a kid, which you will get a sneak preview of later in this podcast. But doing the Kirsten play was extra fun because I had more friends who wanted to do it than there were parts in the play. So we like wrote extra characters and stuff. So definitely a fan of American Girl and definitely a fan of Kirsten.
So this is interesting to me because I also had plays like fundamentally tied into American Girl, but I did not have the official scripts like Emmy has brought us today. So I had two best friends when I was little. We had different American Girl dolls. And I actually had Samantha, not Kirsten. She was a later acquisition that my kids play with. But we each had, Liz had Kirsten, I had Samantha, and Katie had Molly. And we would, I believe, inspired by Marta's death in the book, stage these very elaborate plays, and there was always a character who died. Like someone always died on the journey. Someone always, and no one wanted to be the dead person. So then we started making these dummies, basically, where we would stuff dresses that Liz's mom would get from like the thrift store, and that would be our death in the book. Which actually was a lot like Old Jack later in the series, where they're just there as a corpse, I guess.
So much inspiration comes from this book, really.
So how did your rereads this time compare to your memories of reading it when you were younger?
Well, one of the funny things is like, so I read Kirsten's books a lot and I read Felicity's books a lot. And I found myself thinking that plots were in one book that were in the other because they're all very similar and a little generic. So like the birthing scene that is in this book, I thought was in Felicity and it turns out it is, but it's different, but it's kind of the same. So I don't know. When I was a kid, I loved these books. And as an adult, you know, I still enjoyed my experience. But if I didn't have the nostalgia, I don't know. I don't know how I would feel about it.
I mean, they're definitely very formulaic, which I think is a part of their appeal, but also maybe as a drawback too. I was reading these and I was amazed by some things I remembered clearly, like down to like, you know, what Kirsten leaves in the mud for her friend that she meets in one of the later books we're going to discuss. But I forgot like major plot point.
I've had a similar experience. I definitely vividly remember some of the illustrations of particularly the first book.
Yes.
And even before rereading them, I knew that they were going to occur. Like during March's death, there are a few illustrations, particularly of the guys carrying her coffin away that really stuck out in my mind very vividly. And then the events of the later books kind of blur together for me, similarly to what Kelsey has said. So, there are some memorable parts, some not so memorable. So revisiting the series as a whole has been interesting to think about what my mind has saved and what it hasn't.
I also had significant like blur over time with these events. But these books made me feel old, y'all. Like, my recollection of these as a kid, well, I remembered Marta dying, which I think has scarred all of us on some level, it sounds like. But I really didn't remember much of anything else, except I had this sort of general sense that Kirsten, along with the other American girls, they were really tough and they were brave and they were cool and they were fearless. And then I read it as an adult and I'm not of that mind anymore. Instead, I was just reading it, being horribly disappointed with how irresponsible she was a lot of the time, which I feel like these are definitely books meant for childhood that, you know, they work for an 8-year-old a lot better than they do for an adult.
I mean, I think the illustrations, I mean, I kind of want to talk about those. They feel like they almost have more depth than the books do. And I think you were saying that you really remembered that picture of her with her forehead pressed to Marta's, you know, and I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, I remember reading this, and, you know, when they're inside the rope coil. But, you know, as I was going through the books, like, the photos really jumped out at me. And I remember looking at those photos for, like, for the first, not photos, I'm sorry, illustrations for the first time. And, like, I mean, I have just vivid memories of those, much more so than the plot.
But there are photos, too, right? And the matter of the books, there's the, like, here's the nonfiction part that supports the fictional text you just read. And there are photos. I had completely forgotten that that part of the book existed.
Me too.
Yeah. No memory of that at all.
I remember the illustrations, but not the photos and the historical info in the back. That part I just completely skipped over, apparently.
Yeah, we were talking a bit, too, about how the illustrations changed from the original release of the series to sort of the current updated editions. Yeah. I much preferred the originals. I thought that the look of those illustrations was really nice. But I was very confused because the beginning of the books start with these portraits, essentially, of Kirsten and her family. And then it says, and friends. But the and friends is also her family, which I did not understand.
Yeah, it just goes back to that formula thing. It can't be family and family.
But she does gain friends. Well, she also loses friends along the way.
Like one per book.
Like all her friends pretty much are gone by the end.
This is true. I mean,
Marta dies, Singing Bird has to leave.
And Mary also
family moves away.
To the Oregon Trail, which, gotta be honest, I wasn't all that hopeful about them.
No.
I played that game. I know how that goes.
I remember what happens when you ford the river.
You die of dysentery.
Always.
Always. So, Hannah, you did a little bit of research on the Pleasant Company history.
Yes, I did. Let me tell you what I found. Okay, so in 1986, 44-year-old Pleasant Roland founded a toy company with the name of Pleasant Company, which would soon spawn the American Girl doll empire. So according to a 2020 Forbes profile of Roland, it was a list of self-made women from a financial standpoint. It indicated that she was motivated by not being able to find dolls for her nieces that she liked, and she was also inspired by a trip to Williamsburg, Virginia. So she wanted options beyond Cabbage Patch and Barbie, something kind of in between that she could, you know, that maybe would be educational as well as fun and kind of aimed at, like, that, I guess, 8 to 12 age range. A timeline I found gave the creation year for the original three American Girl dolls as 1985, which makes sense with the company being founded in 1986. They released Kirsten, Samantha, and Molly the same year. So Roland created Pleasant Company with the $1.2 million she had earned as a textbook author. Pleasant Company would become a hugely successful business, like $300 million in sales. And in 1998, it was sold to Mattel for $700 million. They then changed the name of the company to American Girl officially. The iconic dolls that they make are 18 inches tall and are intended to appeal to girls 8 and up. So the original three, Kirsten, Samantha, and Molly, were the start of what is now called the historical line. And they were Kirsten, her set in 1854, Samantha, 1904, so the turn of the century, and then Molly, 1944. They each came with six books that told their stories, and the stories all follow a similar pattern. We'll have more about those later. Each doll has a plethora of accessories and outfits that could be purchased. Pleasant Company also introduced pretty soon after the dolls were released historical clothing for humans so that the owner of the dolls and the doll could match. In 1998, they went from a mail order catalog only to opening up an in-person retail store in Chicago, and then they expanded from there. The Kirsten doll, Kirsten, who we're talking about today, was archived in 2010, although for the Pleasant Company, now American Girl Doll's 35th anniversary, she was brought back. So you can buy that right now for something they're calling the birthday collection. For the low, low price of $150, you can own a Kirsten doll that is, from the website, quote, almost just like the original doll from 1986. You can also get a mini Kirsten doll for $25, which comes with a tiny, albeit abridged, version of her book, Meet Kirsten.
All right. Thanks, Hannah. So now we're going to dive into a little summary of each book, and we're going to do it a little differently for the American Girl series. We're going to summarize each one of the six books, and then we're going to discuss the plot of that book so we don't get them all mixed up, because as we've already said, they're a little easy to jumble together. So we're going to start off with our first book in the original six, Meet Kirsten. So in this book, Kirsten Larsen, an 8-year-old girl from Sweden, travels to America with her family and the family of her friend, Marta, in 1854. After a stop in New York, in which Kirsten uses her smarts to get help finding her family after briefly losing them, they take a train and then another boat. On that second boat, Marta contracts cholera and dies. Kirsten's family cannot afford to hire a cab, so they must leave most of their prized possessions behind and walk the last leg of their journey before finally settling on Kirsten's uncle's farm in Minnesota. What did we think about this one?
Well, full disclosure, none of these titles made any sense to me in terms of aligning with the events of the stories at all. So I had to rename all of these books so I would remember which was which in my notes. And I called this one the one where Kirsten quickly forgets her dead friend. She pretty instantly gets over Marta's death, which I do you think Lars felt bad? Because he said, quote, no one on our ship has cholera, and totally jinxed this girl to death.
She almost should feel bad.
She died.
That is not a good look.
Totally jinxed her.
Yeah. Here's tough look for Lars.
The thing about mentioning cholera in the book, something that I noticed, because the books are really, really brief, we've all mentioned a lot of dramatic stuff happens in them. So something that really jumped out to me on the reread was how, like, over the head the foreshadowing is that they hit you with. They, like, mention cholera every other chapter just to get you ready for the fact that it may happen. And it happens with big events later on, too. But Lars saying that was one of the examples where they were like, remember cholera? Remember? And then you have to
hint, hint.
Yeah.
when we first started talking about, you know, doing the series and which ones we would read, like, my literal first memory of these books is cholera. Like, that's the first word that comes to mind, because I very distinctly remember reading this book for the first time and then coming downstairs to ask my mom and my grandma, who were there at the time, what cholera was. Because after reading the book, I still didn't really know. And I was very traumatized by the fact that this child just died very abruptly. And then we never talk about her again.
Well, they don't explain at all, like, how it works. They're like, oh, she has a fever and her stomach hurts. But, like, I remember vividly, as we all did, it sounds like, you know, Marta dying from cholera. But I remember reading this book going, okay, she dies. I don't know what cholera is, but it's clearly deadly. And then I remember watching, I don't know, some movie my parents were watching. I don't even know what it was, but they had like an entire dining room full of people just die from cholera. And my mother's like, they died from cholera. And I'm thinking, what is cholera? Like, it was like, you know, that meme about quicksand. They're like, when you're a kid and you're like, oh, this is very dangerous, and I don't really understand how it works. Like, it felt like that to me, except cholera is actually more real than quicksand.
And yeah. How many children were really like traumatized by this and thought like, I don't feel good today. My stomach hurts. Hope it's not cholera.
I know. I think that's what was the scary part, is like, it seemed like a flu. Like, it just seemed like a normal, like, illness, like, that you could just, like, you might have already experienced. like they didn't really distinguish it from other illnesses. So like, yeah, then I was like, oh my God, like what was it that killed her? Can I get that? Like how?
I feel like with this first book overall, there are a lot of really intense big picture things that happens. And for me, comparing it with the other American Girl books, usually the Meet Whoever book is the first book in the series. And it just gives you like a general introduction to who the character is in their normal life. And for Kirsten, it's so different from the others because she is not only moving from America, she loses her best friend. A lot of stuff happens really quickly. So I just think it's interesting as the first book and an introduction to her character to have so much stuff happen to her at once. That's why it's the most memorable to me because so much happens.
That's a really good point. Like she's not starting out in a stable. Here we are in our farm in Sweden. Like we don't really find out why they say, oh, it's for a better life. But what does that mean? Are they starving in Sweden? Like, you know, that's just totally glossed over. Like we see her at a time of massive change in her life. Like, as you were saying, it's not the same as some of the other books.
Yeah. Well, and so, yeah, so her friend dies and then she immediately has to leave her like most prized possession in a trunk in some random city and like hoof it on her feet to wherever she's living. That I was very stressed on that during that scene as well. Like that was a lot to come from the cholera thing. And then she has to just like, I remember as a kid thinking Sari was so cool and like wanting my own Sari doll. And then for her to like us to just meet Sari and then for her to be like, okay, bye, Sari, not going to see you again for a while.
I really did want to bring up the dolls because I thought it was very interesting that she and Marta play with their dolls. She goes, Anna and Lisbeth, her cousins, also have dolls that they play with. I was wondering if this may be subtle marketing for the American Girl dolls for people who read the books and see how much fun they're having with their dolls. Their dolls like comfort them when they're going through all these stressful, changeful events, and then they can still play with them. But like as a reader, you'd be like, this is great. I would love to have one. And then you'd be like, you can have one. It's an American Girl doll. You can buy it.
God, it totally was. And it totally worked.
And she fits in the trunk too.
Yes.
Just like, sorry.
It's like,
it's very
Cruella
meta.
Marketing.
It's the doll of the doll who is your doll. There's a lot of.
And also, I just want to say, she brings up Sari a lot more than she ever brings up Marta.
Yeah, she really does.
She does almost immediately get over Marta's death because then she moves and she has Lisbeth and Anna. And it's like, you're my new best friends.
Whatevs.
Nice knowing you, Marta.
Okay, so let's move to Kirsten Learns a Lesson. So in this book, Kirsten begins to attend school and is struggling to keep up with her English. Overwhelmed by her strict teacher who wants her to learn a poem by heart. On her way home from school one day, Kirsten befriends an indigenous girl named Singing Bird by exchanging secret gifts with her. What did we think about this one?
Well, I know they were saying that Miss Winston was a nice teacher, but she was super mean.
She's the worst.
Yeah, I hesitate to wonder what Mr. Coogan was at the teacher who fell off his horse or something.
Well, Mary said all of their teachers prior to Miss Winston were awful.
Right. So if
so,
Miss Winston's a nice one.
Point.
My mind was blown when I didn't remember that she was only 19, or maybe when I was a kid, 19 seemed a lot older than it does now. But like, you know, and then Amos is like the same age. And I'm like, this has got to be super awkward to have like a 19-year-old teaching another 19-year-old in this, you know, sort of small, pioneer school environment.
And I was confused about the Amos thing too, because I kind of remembered him having a bigger role in the books, and like I kind of felt like he was set up to have a bigger role, and then like he's just never mentioned again.
Yeah,
like
he just disappears.
Like why did we need to learn about the 19-year-old in the class if all he's gonna do is kill water?
It was supposed to be foreshadowing, right? I read it and I was like, oh, this is a meet cute between Amos and Miss Winston, and this is gonna go somewhere. No, it doesn't.
I felt the same way, and I think I was personally mixing it up with the Anne of Green Gables series, where a teacher does get together with one of the students.
Oh, yes, with Chrissy Andrews.
Yeah. It's the same thing where the teacher is sort of young, and the students can be almost the same age. So I was thinking, oh, they probably get together, if not in this book, one of the later books, but they don't really mention Miss Winston after the fourth book, and they don't mention Amos at all.
And I didn't appreciate it.
Yeah, this book was the worst of the six, I think. Yeah. And it was the most problematic, which we'll talk about later, because yikes.
Yeah, we'll get to Singing Bird.
Yeah, my alternate title for this one was the one with the well-intentioned but problematic depiction of Native Americans. Yes. And I think that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, it's accurate.
Yeah. Okay, so Kirsten's surprise. Kirsten wants her father to pick up the belongings that they had to leave behind when they first immigrated from a nearby town so that she and her cousins can surprise their family with a St. Lucia Day celebration. When Papa and Kirsten finally set off, they encounter dangerous conditions and almost get stuck in the snow. Kirsten must be brave and help them find their way home using the knowledge she learned from Singing Bird.
So this is the one with the catastrophic knee injury and a blizzard. A lot of drama in this one. Yeah. Also, just stop with the trunks. It was a lot. 19 pages she was talking about the trunks. These are short books.
Yes.
I don't know. I was proud of her for being so brave and leading the sleigh home. That was mm-hmm. clearly very difficult, and I couldn't imagine myself doing that. I hate snow. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the whole thing with the trunks, Kirsten was being really, really annoying about it. I do think they were trying to show, like, her mom constantly says, people are more important than things. And that's something that they mentioned in the first book, and her mom is, like, continually saying it. And I think they are trying to show that, like, for them, since they're so far away from the people that they know, like, back in Sweden, the things, like, represent more than just things. They're, like, connections to people that they have. So I can see how it was important for her to get that so that they could have their celebration. But
yeah, I'm not sure that Kirsten ever internalizes the people are more important than things lesson, because she's always talking about things. She's like talking about her doll all the time. She's much more concerned about sorry and remembering sorry than she is about remembering Marta. Then the quilt. She's really obsessed with the quilt.
Oh, yeah.
And it's more about the things. But
which I think is true for kids. Like, it sort of makes sense.
Well, and I guess when you really don't have much at all because you burn your house down, you aren't going to really care about the few things you do have. But, oh, boy.
I will agree, for me, the St. Lucy Day celebration at the end stood out a lot. Especially for me as a kid, our family also celebrated St. Lucia Day. And my family, side of the family, comes from Norway, where they also celebrate it. So for me, I had memories of like doing that celebration and wearing the little crown with like the candles. But we used electric candles because of the fire hazard. But it was interesting to me to see in a book something that was a family tradition for me as well. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. Although, to be perfectly honest, although like there's a Scandinavian background in my family, I don't know if my mother got the Kirsten books and doll for my sister, and then we celebrated St. Lucia Day with, you know, we had like Swedish buns with saffron and the candles. And I asked my sister if they were real candles, and she said she couldn't remember, but they might have been. So we might have, you know,
living
burned
on the edge.
Yes, burned our hair at some point. But I don't know if my mom was reading the books with us and was like, let's celebrate it too. You know, you have Swedish ancestry and we're reading this book. So I don't know which came first in my family, to be entirely honest. I should ask about that.
That's kind of cool if it inspired a new tradition.
Yeah, it's a little
to your heritage.
Backwards, possibly, but still kind of fun. We enjoyed it. So the food was delicious. The candles were pretty.
The bread with the saffron is really good.
Oh, my God.
We used to put orange and cranberries in it also.
Used to put what?
Orange and cranberries in the bread, and then we make it into a braid, and the saffron's on it. It's really good.
We didn't do that. I want to try that. I have to try making it again. That sounds like it would be delicious.
Okay, so the next book is Happy Birthday, Kirsten. And a lot happens in this book. So there's a tornado scare, a barn raising, Kirsten's mother and their cat, Missy, gives birth, and they celebrate Kirsten's birthday. Kirsten also gets her friends engaged in a quilting bee, but Kirsten is unable to keep up because of the additional chores she must do to help her mother now that the baby has arrived. And I will say, I think growing up, this might have been my favorite book because I really liked Kirsten's outfit in the cover, her spring outfit, and like her little apron. And I think I had a cookbook where you could make the like treats that they would have had at her birthday party. I feel like there was something with lemon involved. That seems wrong. Now that I think about it, they probably wouldn't have lemon in Minnesota. But I have like vague, like fuzzy memories of like trying to recreate her birthday party at some point. So I think that happened in my life, but unsure. What did we feel about this one?
Her birthday outfit was very cute. She got to wear her hair down also.
Yeah, like, I loved her hair.
Yep.
It was the pink and white stripes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good outfit.
Yeah. And her hair, like my hair has a very similar texture to hers, especially when I was younger. So I think I respected that as well, like the light blonde waves.
And the birthday wreath I thought was really pretty.
Yeah.
We get candles last book, and now we have, flowers. So that's probably safer.
I really liked the quilting plot line in this book. I used to do a lot of sewing as a kid. Actually, for the Kirsten plays, my friends and I sewed little bonnets to wear that matched hers. So I used to really like sewing and quilting. And I feel like a birthday where your friends get together and sit down and everyone is sewing a quilt sounds awesome.
I think this was probably my favorite of the books, too. Even though in my head canon, it's called The One with the Boring Tornado and a Baby. There's a lot of dark topics. We get maternal and fetal death are brought up. There's the lady that had the twins and expires during childbirth and loses one of the babies. And then the other one gets raised as the child of the grandparents, I believe.
Yeah.
There's the tornado scare. There's a lot going on in this one, but the friendships with the girls and the quilt I thought was really nice. I thought it was sweet that they knew Kirsten was feeling left out because she was working with the baby and not going to school, and that they did the quilt for her. This one was nice.
And I mean, I feel like I enjoyed the kitten plot a lot too. I loved the cute little kitten illustrations. This, I do think, starts off a new character trait for Kirsten that we haven't really seen at all before, which is she loves animals, which we see in the next two books. And I think sometimes she doesn't really handle it that well. And perhaps her giving the kitten milk is just the start of a lot of bad decisions related to animals that Kirsten makes.
Kirsten loves animals, but animals don't love her.
Yeah.
Okay, so then after her birthday, we have Kirsten Saves the Day. Kirsten discovers a bee tree while playing in the woods by their cabin and is almost attacked by a bear after trying to get the honey from the tree by herself. Foolish Kirsten.
She didn't save the day. This is what I'm talking about with the titles. She created a terrible situation and luckily didn't die.
But she saves the day because she gets them more money at the
market. For the honey, she also gets her dog maimed.
That's true.
There's an alternate reality here where the mama bear like kills her and the dog and her, and was it Lars?
Peter.
And you know, she's just incredibly lucky that that did not happen. They even like say in the book, like, bears can climb trees. The bear just chose not to climb the tree.
Yeah. And I found myself really interested too by like, she was just going to like kill all the bees and take their honey. And right? She really should have like preserve the hive and all the combs and like properly stored them. Obviously lack of foresight there, but I thought that was a good lesson of like, do your research, you know, preserve the wildlife as much as you can, maybe get some help if you don't know things. It's okay not to know things.
Yeah, Kirsten's hubris in this one was nearly fatal.
Yeah.
This is another one where I read it through adult eyes and I was just like, what are you doing? Why do you think you know what you're doing with these bees? You clearly don't know what you're doing with the bees. I don't know. And then the bear, and I felt so bad for the dog, Caro.
Yeah, Caro.
Here's the thing. Kirsten said, I found this bee tree, and she like writes her name on it, but it was really the dog that found it. So no credit to the dog.
The honey belongs to him. Well, belongs to the bees, but belongs to Caro more than it belongs to Kirsten. Yeah. Well,
and the dog protects them from the bear, too, and gets maimed in the process. And no credit to the dog.
It should be Caro saves the day, really.
They should have used the profits to buy Caro like a nice juicy bone or something rather than a hat.
Definitely.
And a knife.
Just a lot of Caro erasure in this book.
Justice for Caro.
Was super disappointed in Kirsten in this book. I gotta be honest.
So was Papa. He was real mad. He was like almost as scary as the bear.
I mean, maybe dad skipped the bee lesson.
But she had seen him work with the bees because then she also mentioned like getting smoke, which that was foreshadowing of the fire in the next book.
Boy.
It's like, Kirsten is a pyro, stop.
Kirsten the firebug.
Yeah, there is a lot of recurring themes here. Animals not faring well and fire not working out well.
Well, it wasn't even just the bear in this one. Like, the bees were a real danger.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if either of those children had been swarmed by bees?
It would have been like the plot of My Girl.
It would have. Anaphylactic shock and
speaking of
Peter
trauma
is Macaulay Culkined off of this mortal coil.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so then the last one we have is changes for Kirsten. So while out trapping furs in the woods with her brother and his friend, John, Kirsten finds and rescues an injured baby raccoon who proceeds to wreak havoc and set the Larson family cabin on fire when he heals and he's accidentally let loose. They'll need quite a bit of money to rebuild or buy a new home, but Kirsten and Lars make a surprise discovery in the woods that just might solve their problems.
This book was wild.
The plot twist.
It took a turn.
Wow. This one I titled The One Where Kirsten Burned Down the House and Has a Sleepover with a Corpse. What is happening in this book? She burns down the house after taking the raccoon that Lars tells her, don't take it home, it's a wild animal. No one even seems to be upset with her for burning down the house, and it really was her fault. Then they go like waltzing around and find a dead man in a cave and then steal all his belongings.
Okay, so the raccoon definitely died, right?
Oh, I think so.
It's like 100% crispy.
Along with her doll that was the second fiddle doll to Sari.
Which was basically just kindling.
Oh, wait,
it was made of husks and straw.
Here's what I was wondering. This was a stressful book. So first there's a fire, and then we see a dead man.
We see a dead man. We sleep in a cave with a dead man. We decide to take all of the dead man's stuff because, well, he didn't have any kids.
He would have wanted them to have it. They figured
that
out.
That was bizarre, too. He didn't even know them.
Right? They're like, he wants us to have it. His soul's in heaven. And he wants us to have his furs.
It's like, no, you never met him.
This dude slept in a cave. He didn't care if you got a 4-bedroom house with windows.
He really didn't care. He probably would have been annoyed.
Old Jack would have thought she was very irresponsible to take the raccoon in the house and would not have wanted her to get all of his furs to buy a new house after she burned the old one down.
Here's the thing for the old Jack plotline. I was, again, thinking of foreshadowing, and they mention old Jack earlier on when they see his old traditional trap, not like ours, which are made of metal because we use modern ones. I thought he was going to help them out by showing them old traditional ways. Like, look at this, folks. I can show you how I do my trapping. It's a lot more successful than yours. But no, they just find him, and they never get to talk to him at all. So there was foreshadowing for old Jack, but not in the way we were expecting.
Yeah,
anyway.
He only appears as a corpse.
I just feel like for this book in general, it's so all over the place. And for me, comparing it to other American Girl Changes books, which is the last book in the series, usually in the other books, there are like life-changing, life-altering historical events that occur in them. Am I allowed to say spoilers for a couple of the other American books?
Hit it.
Yes. Okay. So in Changes for Addie, the Civil War ends. In Changes for Molly, her dad comes home from the war. In Changes for Samantha, she moves to New York with her aunt and uncle who have adopted her. So it's all like big, they're all doing like huge things in their life.
Well, and like they get this new house, like obviously that's a change, but it's not like they were ever talking about like, oh man, this house is too small for us and we're cramped and like we need more space or like we don't have a kitchen that we need or whatever. It's just like our house burned down, now we have a new one. Yeah, not a huge change.
Each episode, our intrepid researcher will enchant us with scintillating factoids related to our book. It's time to dive in and explore Ella's ephemera.
Hi there, everyone. I'm Ella, and this is my ephemera, the part of the podcast where I tell you about some of the neat things I've learned while doing research. I started reading the American Girl book series in the middle of my transition from picture books to chapter books. So you can imagine why the illustrations have always stuck with me. But there's something special about the way Kirsten's family and friends are drawn in two group photographs in the beginning of her books. Let's imagine for a moment that these were real photographs taken in the 1800s. They would have used a process called the daguerreotype. The daguerreotype was the first publicly available photographic process and was widely used during the 1840s and 1850s. I won't bore you with the long process of taking one of these photographs, But the gist was that the photographer needed extremely bright light and a long exposure time. It was a difficult combination to achieve. In one early attempt at a portrait, a Swedish amateur daguerreotypist caused his sitter to nearly lose an eye because of practically staring into the sun during the 5-minute exposure. Because of this, group photos were incredibly rare, if they existed at all. That might be why Kirsten and her family were illustrated into individual portraits when the central series went through a revision. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive. I'm Ella, and this was my ephemera.
So I wanted to share a brief history of Minnesota immigration. Between 1850 to 1930, there was a huge wave of Swedish immigrants to Minnesota, so Kirsten's family would have been at the start of that. It was called the Minnesota Territory until it became a state in 1858. The main occupants of the land that would become Minnesota were the indigenous Dakota and Ojibwe people. We wanted to talk a little about how these books hold up, and I think there are some questions about how well the books hold up in terms of its depiction of the time and of Native American characters in history. What do you all think?
I feel like I described it earlier as cringe, and I think someone else wrote that in their notes, and I was very stressed the entire time reading the Singing Bird plotline. I started out stressed because Miss Winston literally was like introducing this plot by calling them savages and like really just, I thought it was going to go that way. And then instead it just made a very like white savory kind of turn, which like was clearly like well-intentioned, but just came off really terrible and like generic Native American like peoples. Like there's never any mention of like what specific tribe they're part of. All the like cultural practices that they have are just very generic. Like someone told me once what one tribe does, and I'm just assuming all tribes do this. Like it was just very gross and not great.
Yeah, I agree. The second book with the Singing Bird storyline was real problematic. There's the monolithic indigenous culture thing as though that can be described in that way. There's nothing specific about it at all. It's just very generic. There's also a lot of weird, I don't know, the dialogue, the way that the author writes the dialogue for Brave Elk and Singing Bird is gross. Like, it's this very clipped, you are yellow hair, you stay. That's infantilizing. It's probably not correct linguistically for how somebody with limited English would speak even. It was awful. Then there's also the like fetishization of Native American culture writ large as the author sees it. So the naming conventions, the you know, the tie into the land, the leaving as sort of a nomadic move to follow the herd. It was painful. Again, my least favorite of the books. I don't think it held up well at all. And then there was really no, I was thinking in the end with the nonfiction part of the book where they're doing the snapshot, there would be something in there, surely, since the whole book sort of hinged on these plot points around Singing Bird, nothing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And like, it bothered me that, confused me that Kirsten would speak English to her when English is not even her native language or like a comfortable language. I know the whole plot of the book is that mm-hmm. she's learning English, but like, it just makes more sense to me that she would be like, this person doesn't know English anyway, so let me speak comfortably to her and like, or teach her some of my Swedish that like actually is my culture and tradition and not like this random language. Like, it was just very like weird to me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everyone's sentiments. To go back to something Heather had said earlier, it really did stand out to me as well that the back matter of the books did not go into any indigenous history in any way. When I read Meet Kirsten, the first book, there's a whole section about immigrants in America, and there is a sentence in there that says most people who live in the United States today have relevant relatives who are immigrants. And so it kind of just paints the picture that, like, that's the main group we're talking about, and that's, like, most people who live there today had immigrant relatives, leaving out people who come from indigenous descent. And then in Kirsten Learns a Lesson, the only subject of the historical information in the back is about school. So it's about, like, schools that what Kirsten would have gone to, but it really doesn't go into the specifics of the indigenous plotline in any way. So it just kind of, as you mentioned, lumps it together and kind of glosses over. There's no research or, like, history into that aspect of it.
We did some research into the history of bangs, and in this time period, they really wouldn't have had blunt cut across the forehead bangs. I think they would have had, like, maybe little curls on the side, but I think it would have been, like, a center part or something like that. So we did a little research into this, and the first three dolls, Kirsten, Samantha, and Molly, which all have the same bangs, were released with the same wig. So here I'm going to quote from the American Girl Doll wiki. Kirsten is portrayed with bangs fringe and has been since released. However, at the time, bangs were not fashionable for most girls or women, with the prevailing style being center parted hair pulled back. Other girls and women shown in her series do not have bangs. The theory is that rather than change the wig design dramatically for newly designed dolls, she was given the same type of hairstyle as Samantha Parkington and Molly McIntyre. So let's talk about the bangs.
They always seemed like they were there to cover up the headpiece. I mean, you can, on the old dolls, Kelsey's is probably like mine, you can, like, see the sort of, like, skull cap wig that's pulled down. So, like, if you pull Kirsten's bangs back, she looks really strange. I mean, it looks like her scalp is separating from her skull if you don't give her bangs. So it seemed like a manufacturing choice always. Like, even when I had the doll, the bangs seemed like they were there to cover the way that the hair was attached to the head.
Yeah. As someone with tryptophobia and doesn't like looking at small holes, the wig is very upsetting to me to look at. But yeah, I mean, they're very iconic of American Girl dolls. Like, I'm having trouble picturing ones that don't have bangs. I know that there are some, but, like, I think in my head, I just mentally put bangs on them.
Felicity has the side part with the little curls.
Yeah.
And I think she was the first one that didn't have bangs. She was the fourth doll released, right? So Felicity, I think she was the first non-bang doll.
I think that's right.
I think with the bangs, too, it's interesting that it's also reflected in the book's illustrations. Like, Kirsten, not only Kirsten has bangs, but all of the other, like, little girl, some of her friends, they have bangs also. They're all wearing different braids, so everyone has their own, like, unique braid. But it, like, follows, I don't know if the doll, I guess, was designed first, but they made everyone else kind of follow it in the drawings.
It makes me wonder if the, like, looped braid is that like a traditional Swedish hairstyle, because she's the only one who wears her braids like that, and it's like a very her style. But several people have the, like, braid over the top of the head thing.
Yeah, there's crown braids. Like, there's the Dutch braid on the one girl in an image.
Also, interestingly, in my book, no one is portrayed with bangs.
Oh.
None of her family.
Well, the illustrations do change between the editions, those original ones versus the more updated ones. They have a very different look to them. I don't know. I mean, bangs seem wildly impractical if you're a pioneer, I have to say. As a person with bangs, keeping up with your bangs would not be fun.
Trimming them, styling them.
Especially, like, in the summer. Like,
I was going
to
say,
they would just be
bonnet.
Stuck to your face all the time.
Well, they have her complaining about her, like, cotton gingham cap that, like, gets sweaty and stuck to her face. Like, the bangs would just be worse, I would think.
I will say her bangs are really thick and luscious. Like, she has some good bangs.
Oh, she does.
She does. It's a heavy fringe.
Yeah. So she's got that going for her, at least. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like, just this idea of historical accuracy in general and like how much matters and what matters. I definitely found myself, and I definitely didn't think about this as a kid, but like as an adult, wondering, kind of like you mentioned earlier, Hannah, like, why are they going to Minnesota? What made Swedish families pick Minnesota? Why were they leaving Sweden? Like, how many people, like, all these things that, like, I never really thought about as a kid, but as an adult, it did raise some questions for me that, you know, I think are good, like, that what historical fiction should do, like, make you want to learn more about the topic or about that time period.
Totally.
I mean, I definitely learned from the book that, like, you should leave a baby cub alone because a mom will be close behind. I feel like that's a good survival skill.
Yeah, well, they have the baby raccoon later on, and her, and Mama says, you know, sometimes they carry diseases. And I'm thinking, is the next book going to be Kirsten has rabies? That would be very dark.
I mean, I think this was one of the first times that I became aware that there were, like, other holidays in general, but also other than the ones that I celebrated or that, like, my friends celebrated. And definitely the first time that I became aware that, like, different people had different traditions, particularly around, like, Christmas time. Like, I knew about Hanukkah and Christmas, and that was it. And, like, I think that was really exciting and interesting for me to be like, oh, like, there's, like, all these different, like, worlds happening that I was not aware of. I think that's why I wanted the outfit, because it was so interesting to me and, like, visually so beautiful, like, the pictures and of that scene in the book. It was just really exciting to read as a kid.
I do know a little bit about why the outfit is important and, like, how that tradition got started. I don't know if we want to go in.
Please.
To that. Okay, briefly. St. Lucy lived in Italy, like, in Rome during the time of persecution for Christians. So there was, like, a community underground that she would bring food to and, like, have candles. So I don't know if she, like, wore them on her head or what, but, like, she would go underground into, like, catacombs where people are hiding out, and she would bring food to them. So often in artwork, she's, like, depicted, it's really dark, and she's, like, wearing candles. And I think symbolically it ties in with, like, winter and then having the candles there. So that's why it's worn on the head.
So Kirsten is a role model. I can kind of guess what some of our answers might be based on our earlier discussion. What do we think? I don't know if I would take Kirsten as an amazing role model, although I want to cut her some slack because she's, you know, 10 at the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like, she seemed very mature isn't the right word, but, like, I don't know, like, the whole, like, her taking care of her sister and doing errands for her mom and coordinating the quilting bee, like, that all seemed very grown up to me when I was reading that as a kid. And so I think for me that was really, like, aspirational, like, or admirable, maybe, that she was, like, doing all those things and, like, able to handle it. As an adult, yes, she's a little more reckless than I remember, but I think it's very honest. Like, she's figuring stuff out. She's, like, fumbling through the world. She's testing her boundaries. She doesn't, like, she handles making mistakes with grace. Like, she's not very, like, down on herself when she messes, makes some pretty serious
when she burns their house down.
Which is admirable, I guess. And she's, like, she's advocates for herself. She wants to do the, like, she wants to go in the sled with her father. She wants to go trapping. Like, I thought that was pretty cool as a kid, that, like, she wanted to, like, get dirty and do the tough stuff, the quote-unquote boy stuff, you know.
For me, I feel like as a young child, she was definitely, I sort of looked up to her as someone who is really resourceful and kind of makes things do with what she has. I personally, as a kid, loved making little things, and, like, she and her friends would make tiny, like, objects for her dolls. Later on, she does the quilting and stuff like that. So I think in that aspect, and then also the aspect of her kind of just really learning how to be herself and be comfortable with moving to a completely new location, learning how to communicate in a different language, that's something I feel like she overcomes over time. So those aspects of her, they are really admirable. Other aspects, as we've all mentioned, she makes a lot of mistakes, which I think is realistic. As a kid, you encounter situations that you don't really know what to do in. And so she kind of has ideas that she really wants. I think a lot of her decisions are motivated by wanting to do something for her family. So that, too, I think is something that can be admired, even if sometimes it causes a lot more problems than it solves. So I think she's kind of well-rounded in that, like, she has some really strong and, like, good intentions, and then they don't always pan out.
We all have these vivid memories of reading the books and playing with the dolls. Why did American Girl resonate so much with us?
I think we'll probably uncover more of this as we read more of the books and find, like, what those common themes are. Maybe we should revisit this question every time and see what new lessons we've learned. But
I agree.
I think just after this first series, there's something comforting about, like, how quickly each book resolves. Like, stuff happens and then, you know, it resolves, you move on to the next one. There's, like, familiar plot elements, but you're including this historical component that makes it kind of, like, interesting and different. And then the fact that you can, like, have a physical object that ties you to the stuff that you're reading, I think is really exciting when you're a kid.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think also there was something very appealing to me about the girls' stories. They did things. They did important things. It didn't seem silly, right? It wasn't just stories about, I got in a fight with my friend at school and then, you know, we had an argument. Then we got back together and it was fine. Like, they're very plotty. You know, there's big drama in them. She lost her friend and she died and then her house burns down. So I think there is something with the resilience there that is meaningful. They feel important in a way. And then I think there's also something appealing about viewing, you know, the lineage of girlness to a degree. So seeing this sort of historical pattern, like, what did it look like to be a girl at this time? And they focus more on the positive elements of that rather than, well, actually, it was really a drag to be a girl at this time. And then it was a drag to be a girl 50 years later than that. They really do focus on what were the positive aspects of being a girl during different historical periods, or what were the opportunities there. So I think that's appealing.
I definitely agree. And I feel like for me, something else that was really resonant was, as with a lot of historical fiction, but I do think American Girl makes this really accessible, is just seeing how people from different time periods have similar thoughts and interests and wants and feelings as someone living in our own time. With Kirsten, we talked about this, but she's really interested in getting her trunks and, like, finding her doll. That's something that, like, for me as a young kid, I could definitely relate to. And then on the reverse, imagining how, like, I myself might react in some of the big situations that the girls encounter. It's just an interesting kind of perspective taking exercise that I think is, in, like, the short and accessible form of the books themselves, it makes it possible to, like, imagine.
Coming up, we'll get an expert's take on an important aspect of this novel that is not often discussed. But first, let's pay some bills.
Learn a new language from home or on the go with Mango. Mango's award-winning courses bring you practical phrases from real-life situations in a way that makes you want to start the conversation. Every learner's experience is unique. Mango adjusts to your learning pace, teaching you until you feel confident with new words and phrases, creating a learning solution centered around you. Visit pgcmls.info and click on the Online Library tab to learn more. Would you like to learn something new while at home? Develop and expand your creativity by learning how to sketch, sew, knit, cook, and more with Creative Bug. All you need is your library card.
All right, now let's talk to someone who actually knows something about one of the main topics featured in this book. Infectious disease.
My name's Amy Cleon, and I'm an infectious disease specialist. I work at the National Institutes of Health in the Laboratory of Parasitic Diseases.
Awesome. So I'm so excited to hear your thoughts about how authentic the portrayal of infectious disease is in this book. So can you tell us a little bit about what is cholera, and is it still around? Is it still something that people get? What is cholera?
So cholera is a gram-negative bacteria that causes infection. It is spread usually in areas of poor sanitation through water or food or sometimes from person-to-person contact. It was really common back in the 1800s and before that because the hygiene wasn't very good and there were huge epidemics. However, it still exists today, and there are some areas of the world, particularly areas of Asia and some areas of Africa, where there are still outbreaks of cholera and people still die. So it is a real problem even now.
Wow. And can you talk about, like, was it a very common thing that would be spread on boats, and why is that the case, if so?
So it's a very common thing spread on boats for a number of reasons. So first of all, the people that, like Kirsten's family, who didn't have a lot of money, were often crammed together on a boat. And so you can imagine that if one person got sick, it was really hard to isolate them from other people. And so very often there would be one person who had cholera, as they described in the book. They would get off the boat, but they had already infected other people. Then the boat would sail and people would be cramped together. They wouldn't be able to isolate them from the person who was sick. And then the infection would spread from person to person or through food handling on the boat. And so, yeah, that was there were many, many epidemics that were on boats going a variety of places.
Wow. So do you feel that the way infectious diseases and particularly cholera is portrayed in the book is authentic?
So for the most part, yeah, I think it was very authentic. I mean, certainly the pace of the illness was very rapid. Typically people would get sick and would have profuse watery diarrhea and just not be able to, especially on a boat, they wouldn't be able to administer fluids. And the person wouldn't be able to drink and wouldn't be able to keep up with the fluid loss and would die in a very short period of time, as they described. So that I think was very accurate. The only thing that perhaps was a little bit atypical is that the girl who was sick seemed to have abdominal pain. And that's not a huge part of cholera diarrhea. It's more that you just lose all your fluid and you can't keep up. And in this day and age, that's the reason that people can, if they're in a proper, an area where they can get adequate fluids and you can keep up with it and give them IVs, that people can survive cholera. But in those kinds of situations on boats, really, the outcome would be what you saw in the book. And so, yeah, I think it was pretty accurate.
That's interesting. I think one of the things we talked about when we were discussing the book is that it seemed a little maybe generic, or like it wasn't clear like what exactly all her symptoms were. So, it's interesting to hear you talk about like what the actual symptoms of cholera were. Cause I think as kids reading it, we were like, oh, she's just ill. Like, what does it mean that she has cholera? We didn't quite pick that up in the same way.
No, but I think that things would progress so quickly that the person would lose so much fluid, they would become pale and tired and not interested in anything and would really rapidly die. So, that's what they described. I think that's real.
Well, great. I'm glad to know that it's at least generally pretty accurate. Especially hope for a historical fiction novel that would be the case. Do you have any pet peeves in general in like popular media of portrayals of infectious diseases that like always seem to recur, or you really wish people would stop doing?
No, but I think one of the real problems is that everybody wants to sensationalize the illness, whatever it is, because people pay attention. In this case, in cholera in the 1800s, I mean, they picked the right historical setting. This is really what happened. And so I think in contrast to some portrayals of diseases where you think, really that would be happening now, or, they have every possible symptom that you can imagine when, regular people would not have everything. That really isn't true in this book. I think they did their homework. The time frame that they picked, there were epidemics on boats from people coming from Scandinavia in particular, coming to the United States, and they would bring cholera with them and spread it to the people in the upper Midwest. And so there were really devastating epidemics of cholera at that time. So I think the book did a particularly good job in that sense.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. And I found this really interesting to add to my understanding of both this book in particular and kind of the historical accuracy of the American Girl books more generally. I'm really glad to hear that it seems okay, at least in this instance. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was nice to talk to you.
Okay, so now we are going to get into something I mentioned earlier. There are theater editions of the American Girl books. So to introduce our game segment, we are going to read perhaps the most dramatic act of the Kirsten play. We'll all be taking on different roles, and we'll give you just a little taste of what American Girl theater can be.
Shall we introduce ourselves as our roles for the audience?
Sure. I'm Marta.
I'm Kirsten.
I'm Mama.
And I'll be your narrator, and I'll also be Papa.
I like
and
Papa
maybe not like that.
Papa and the bear.
Are we ready? Act 4. Scene. In the sick bay, just before dawn, Marta is laying on a straw mattress on the ground. Kirsten enters. She kneels beside Marta. Marta moans and rolls her head from side to side. Kirsten smooths the pillow and puts Marta's doll next to her in bed.
Oh, Kirsten?
Yes, I'm here, Marta. Lie back.
You shouldn't be here.
I had to see you. Do you feel better?
I'm tired. I just feel very tired.
Papa says we will get to Minnesota today, Marta. When we get to Minnesota, we will be home. You will feel better.
No, I don't think so, Kirsten.
Of course you will. You must get well. I will hate Minnesota if you aren't well and we can't play together there. It will never feel like home then.
You mustn't say that. Home is wherever you have friends. Your cousins will be your friends. They will make you feel at home.
But you are my best friend. I'll be so lonely if we are not together.
Look, Kirsten, the sun is coming up.
Yes, I see it.
Remember what your grandmother told you? Remember what you and I said about the sun?
Whenever I miss you, whenever I am lonely, I should look at the sun and think of you.
Remember, we all see the same sun.
But Marta!
God bless you, Kirsten.
Marta? Marta! Oh, Marta!
Kirsten holds Marta's hand to her cheek and cries. Mama and Papa enter. They kneel behind Kirsten.
Kirsten!
She's dead, Mama. Marta is dead.
The poor child.
God rest her soul.
Marta. Marta. My friend.
Come, Kirsten. We must go. The boat has docked. It is time for us to go ashore.
But what will happen to Marta?
The sailors will bury her here. Her soul is in heaven.
No. No!
Kirsten sobs and buries her head in her arms.
There, there. Enough tears. Stop now, Kirsten.
Let her have her tears.
Mama and Papa put their arms around Kirsten. Kirsten looks up at the sun.
God bless you, Marta.
Kirsten, Mama, and Papa exit. And Marta doesn't because she's dead. All right, so it's time for our Bechdel test segment. Each episode, we ask whether our book passes the Bechdel test. The Bechdel test asks whether a work features two female characters who talk to each other about something that doesn't involve men or boys. So, does American Girl Kirsten Larsen pass the Bechdel test?
I think most of them do, but I feel like a couple of the books may not have.
I wasn't sure if we were supposed to evaluate this with the whole, like, all six books, do they together pass the test or individually? Because I think altogether, for they do, but yeah, like you said, maybe not for some of them if we look at each book by itself.
The only one I'm worried, well, okay, so the Kirsten surprise one, she talks to her cousins about planning the St. Lucia event surprise, so that passes. The one I was worried about was the old Jack one, but her mom warns her not to put the raccoon in the barn.
So, I mean, is it a boy raccoon?
That because might count, question mark.
Yeah, that one was a concern. And then my other one was the blizzard one. But you're right. They did talk about their preparations for their holiday. And I think they didn't mention the menfolk.
I think it passes.
I think so. It doesn't pass in a way that's like dramatic and clear, but
it's not
technically
sailing over the bar, but it does pass.
Right. Squeaks over it, but just a little bit of space.
I do think in the last book, the one we were concerned about, there are a lot of conversations that maybe don't stand out in the plot, but between Aunt Inger and Mama and the cousins, because all of the
about the house
the
that
men are away. Yeah, so they like kind of plan and talk about their move and stuff. So.
See, but I didn't think that counted, because then they would be like, so John, how much are you selling your house for? Or like, well, Papa will be back in this much time. So it's like, I felt like those were very dense with male references, but maybe they weren't.
I mean, I think it passes.
It's close enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode of These Books Made Me. Join us next time when we'll discuss a book in which an orphan and a servant girl embark on a literacy program. If you think you know which book we're tackling next, drop us a tweet. We're at PGCMLS on Twitter and hashtag ThesebooksMadeMe. You can also send us your questions at ThesebooksMadeMe@PGCMLS.info. And for historical deep dives and read-alikes, check out our blog, which is linked in the episode notes.